cause, you know. Lizzie frowned. Are you accusing Mrs. Whitworth of causing her husband's accident?
Well, Ophelia sat back, looking deflated. Not really, I suppose. I just thought maybe, I mean, I have a feeling that...
Her voice trailed away.
What?
Lizzie asked.
Oh, I don't know, Opie said testily. But there's another thing, Liz. It turns out that Mr. Whitworth was in partnership with Bodine Pyle, which certainly doesn't make him look good.
She took a breath.
Regina Whitworth was pretty upset about that. I had to wonder if that was her reason for wanting the divorce. She surely wouldn't be happy if word got around that she was married to a bootlegger.
Bodine Pyle? Lizzie frowned. She was surprised by this, for Mrs. Whitworth hadn't said anything about a partnership with Pyle in last week's interview with Mr. Mosley. Perhaps she hadn't known it at the time. But the woman had told Mr. Mosley something else about her husband, something equally illegal and incriminating, something that had spurred her to consider divorce, and Lizzie thought about it now. Regina Vautier had been just 19 when she married Whitney Whitworth.
I was a wide-eyed innocent, she'd said. Just a baby, really, and all alone in the world.
She had known next to nothing about financial matters, and cared even less, so was far more interested in romance. In fact, she had believed that her new husband, older than she, experienced and romantic, was a wealthy man, and that he was paying all their bills with his money. She had simply assumed that hers was still in the bank, and she could take it out and spend it whenever she wanted. But recently she had discovered, to her dismay, that this was not the case. All this time, they had been living on her inheritance, not his income. When she learned this, she had begun to think about divorce. But there was another part to the story, which Regina Whitworth had told Mr. Mosley only because he had warned her that she had to tell him everything or he couldn't represent her. She said she had always wanted to learn to drive, but Mr. Whitworth wouldn't let her. Women were too scatterbrained to drive, he'd told her, and anyway, the Pierce Arrow was too large an automobile for her to manage. He would drive her where she needed to go. Finally, in an act of rebellion, she had gone to the bank to withdraw the money to buy a new car. That's when she discovered that her husband had nearly depleted her account. Angrily, she had taken what was left and bought a car for herself. Frank Harwood, the Kilgore salesman, was teaching her to drive, and she had fallen in love with him. "We are not having an affair," she had said quickly and insistently, as if anticipating Mr. Mosley's question. "I could never do such a thing. But Frank wants me to marry him, and I've told him I will consider it after Whitney and I are divorced." That was the full story, and as Lizzie thought about it, she could see why Regina Whitworth hadn't wanted Sheriff Norris to know that she'd been planning a divorce. If there were any questions about the cause of that car wreck, she would be the first one to fall under suspicion. "Well, then," Lizzie said quietly, "I think I'd better call Mr. Mosley and fill him in on what's happened. The fact that Whitworth was involved with Bodine Pyle raises some other questions."
"I'm sure it does," Ophelia got up, smoothing her dress around her hips. "Well, I'd better get downstairs and give Charlie what little I've got for his story."
She hesitated for a moment, biting her lip.
"I wonder..."
She fell silent.
"Wonder what?"
Lizzie asked, reaching for the telephone on the corner of her desk.
"About that car," Ophelia said. "Regina Whitworth's new car, I mean. I'll bet it's in the Whitworth's garage, Liz. Do you suppose we should go over there after dark tonight and take a look at..."
"No," Lizzie said emphatically. "We should not." If Mr. Mosley asked her to check out that car, that was one thing. Going there with Ophelia was quite another. Opie sighed.
"I suppose you're right. Well, see you later, Liz. Enjoy your flowers."
The minute she was gone, Lizzie lifted the receiver.
She was about to dial the exchange to place a long-distance call to Mr. Mosley's Montgomery office when the telephone rang. "Law offices," she said pleasantly. "How may we help you?" The woman on the other end of the line was shrill and imperative. "Your Mr. Mosley can keep Mr. Dunlap from going to jail, Elizabeth. That's how you can help."
"Mama?" Lizzie felt chilled. "Mama, is that you?"
"Of course it's me," Mrs. Dunlap snapped. "I want you to send Mr. Mosley over to the Five and Dime right now, Elizabeth. Right now, do you hear me? That sheriff's deputy is back there in the office right now questioning my husband."
Trying to be calm, Lizzie said, "Mr. Mosley is in Montgomery, Mama. He won't be back for a day or two." She hesitated.
"The deputy is questioning Mr. Dunlap about what? What's happened?"
"About killing Mr. Whitworth, that's what. And if somebody doesn't do something, he is going to haul my dear Mr. Dunlap off to jail."
She took a breath.
"And it's all because of Leona Ruth Adcock, that wretched old busybody. When I get my hands on her, I'm going to..."
"Killing Mr. Whitworth?" Lizzie was aghast. "But why, Mama? I understand that Mr. Whitworth died accidentally in a car wreck. What could Leona Ruth possibly know that..."
"She doesn't know anything, Elizabeth." Her mother's voice dripped acid. "She is making it all up."
"Well, of course she is," Lizzie said, trying to be comforting. "I'm sure Mr. Dunlap won't be going to jail."
"Well, I'm not," her mother snapped. "If you're not interested in helping us, I will call Gerald Cankren. He did some legal work for Mr. Dunlap last summer. I'm sure he'll be glad to see that Mr. Dunlap is released."
Lizzie sighed. She had learned through long, frustrating experience that there was no use in trying to argue with her mother, who was very good at twisting what people said to make them think that they were in the wrong. And as far as Leona Ruth Adcock was concerned, well, that old woman made it her business to put people in the wrong, all for the momentary glorying of feeling herself in the right.
"Whatever you think, Mama," Lizzie said quietly. Gerald Cankren was one of Darling's other two lawyers, and not a very good one. At least, that was Mr. Mosley's opinion, and it must be accurate, since he regularly bested Mr. Cankren when they ended up on opposite sides of a case.
"Well, then, goodbye, and no thanks to you, Elizabeth," her mother retorted angrily and banged down the phone.
Lizzie sat for a moment thinking. She knew her mother well enough to discount her dramatic exaggerations. Nothing was ever as bad, or as good, as her mother said it was. But if Mr. Dunlap was being questioned, the sheriff must think there was something to Leona Ruth's accusation. What was it? She couldn't reveal what she knew. That would be to violate Mr. Mosley's confidentiality rule. But the rule didn't have to keep her from learning more if she could, and she felt that to be an obligation now that Mr. Dunlap was somehow involved. She pulled the phone toward her and dialed the exchange. First, though, she had to tell Mr. Mosley that Mr. Whitworth was dead and find out what further instructions he might have. Charlie Dickens walked confidently into the Darling Savings and Trust, expecting to see Alvin Duffy sitting in his glassed-in office, keeping an eye on the goings-on in the lobby. Charlie knew for a fact that while Al might look like your ordinary mild-mannered banker, he was a crack shot and kept a loaded revolver in the top drawer of his desk. It was just a common-sense precaution, Al insisted, given the rash of bank robberies that had plagued the nation since the beginning of the Depression.
"Nobody's going to rob my bank," he said, whenever the subject came up.
All of Darling believed him and felt a little safer when they took their money out from under the bed and entrusted it to Mr. Duffy's bank. But Al Duffy was not at his desk when Charlie went in.
"He's in Atlanta this week," Alice Ann Walker explained. She had recently been promoted from teller and was now Mr. Duffy's secretary.
"Can I do something for you, Mr. Dickens?"
Charlie hesitated. What he had come for was a look at Fanny's canceled checks to see if he could figure out who, or what, J.C. was, and why his wife was sending this person, or company or organization, $50 every month. Al was a friend of his, so he figured that, man to man, he could ask that little favor. But Alice Ann and Fanny were both Dahlias, and they were pretty friendly. Even if she let him have a look, she might very likely tell Fanny about it. Charlie was planning to keep his little investigation out of sight. So, no, on balance, he didn't think Alice Ann could help him.
"He's out all week," he said. "When will he be back?"
Alice Ann tapped her pencil on the calendar on her desk. "Well, he originally said Friday, but then he mentioned going down to Jacksonville after Atlanta. I'm sorry, but I really couldn't tell you exactly when." She smiled pleasantly. "Speaking of travelers, have you heard from Fanny yet? When is she due to get to New York?"
"Tomorrow," Charlie said,
glad that he hadn't mentioned his errand to Alice Ann.
"It's a long trip with a couple of changes."
"Well, when you talk to her, tell her I'm thinking about her. I had a peek at some of her hats before she packed them up. I know she'll do very well." Alice Ann wrinkled her forehead. "Are you sure I can't help you, Mr. Dickens?"
"I'm afraid not," Charlie said. "But thanks."
It looked like he was going to have to live with his puzzle a little while longer. Chapter 18. The Sheriff and the Bootlegger. When Mrs. Adcock had gone, Buddy Norris went into Wayne's office and told him what she had said about the bad blood between Dunlap and Whitworth.
"I don't think it amounts to anything much," Buddy said. "Leona Ruth is bad about getting things mixed up, but Dunlap lied to me this morning when I talked to him about Whitworth, so we need to check it out."
"I'll do it." Wayne pulled a page out of his battered Royal typewriter. "Here's what I've got on the accident." He nodded toward the stack of photos. "And there are Dickens' photos."
Buddy took the report and picked up the photographs.
"Thanks. Bodine Pyle lives with his mother on the other side of town. I'm headed over there to see if I can talk to him. I want to find out where he was last night and who was with him."
Wayne arched an eyebrow.
"With his mama?"
"Yep. The Pyle boys may come down on the wrong side of the liquor laws, but they take good care of their own. Bodine was supporting two grandmothers up until last year when both of them died."
Wayne nodded.
"How about a sandwich before you go? Got some bologna in the icebox if you're hungry."
He grinned.
"Bottle of cold beer, too."
"Sounds good to me," Buddy said,
thinking again that he'd hired himself the right deputy. Bodine Pyle lived with his mother and his brother Beau on Pleasant View, which was anything but. The red dirt street, ankle-deep in red mud when it rained, was lined with junky front yards, dilapidated houses set on piles of bricks, and scrawny trees. The small gardens and chicken yards were unsuccessfully fenced against rabbits, deer, and the neighborhood boys, who made a habit of snatching ripe sweet corn, watermelons, and fresh eggs. The Pyle's house was as ramshackle as the rest, its white-painted wood siding weathered to a defeated gray, with a sagging front porch and a rusty tin roof. Inside, though, it was a different story. Buddy had been there a time or two and had seen the new Frigidaire and Magic Chef gas range, the chrome kitchen dinette set with shiny red chairs, and the plush sofa and matching armchair in the parlor. Bodine's mama refused to move out of the old house where she'd lived her whole life, but she allowed her son to use his moonshine profits to make things easier and more comfortable for her. The front steps were guarded by a pair of coonhounds too lazy to do more than lift their heads when Buddy pulled up in front. A stripped-down 1932 black Ford that belonged to Bodine's younger brother, Beau, was parked just ahead of him on the street. A fast car, it could easily outrun the old Model T four-door sedan that Buddy had inherited from Roy Burns. That is, it could until Buddy had bolted on a high-compression cylinder head and installed a high-speed camshaft and a bigger carburetor. On the door, he had painted a six-pointed star around the words, "Cypress County Sheriff," and added a red light and an ear-splitting siren rigged to run off the battery. He'd also anchored a sturdy strip of hog wire across the back of the front seat, so if he had to haul a prisoner, the guy couldn't grab him from behind and get him in a chokehold. Although he was still itching for an opportunity to prove its merits, he was confident that his souped-up Model T could now outrun almost anything on the road. Dispiritedly, the coonhounds left the steps and flopped down under a cottonwood tree at the edge of the yard, displacing a red rooster and a couple of squawking hens. As Buddy rapped on the screen door, he could hear a soothing male voice announcing that it was time to tune in to Oxydol's own Ma Perkins. The announcer was abruptly throttled when somebody switched off the radio. Bodine's mother answered Buddy's knock. Her gray hair was wound on top of her head, and fuzzy tendrils frizzed around her face. She wore a green checked cotton dress and a flower sack apron that still bore the washed-out brand name Sunbonnet Sue Flower. She glanced at the badge on Buddy's shirt pocket. Her tone was resigned.
"Which one you looking for this time?"
"Bodine, ma'am," Buddy said, taking off his hat respectfully. The Piles had three sons, young Beau, a rakishly good-looking troublemaker, Bodine, and the older boy, Randall, who joined a gang over around Atlanta and was said to keep busy robbing banks. Old Man Pyle had just been released from Wetumpka, also known as The Walls, where he had served a 5-year sentence for knifing a man in a fight in a speakeasy in Monroeville. Of the lot, Bodine showed the most self-discipline and industry, although the industry he was involved in was generally considered illegal. His still had already been shut down once by that pesky revenue agent Chester P. Kennard, but that had been a temporary setback, and it wasn't long before he had relocated from the south end of Briar Swamp to the north. Following Roy Burns' lead, Buddy had so far considered Bodine's bootlegging as none of his business. That is, it was none of his business until Bodine got up to something else illegal, like thieving or murder, in which case he'd have to do something about it.
"Well, Bodine ain't here," Mrs. Pyle said in a resentful tone.
Buddy wondered whether she ever got tired of defending her kin or worrying about what they were up to.
"Happen to know where I can find him?"
Somewhere in the house, a male voice shouted,
"Ma, you made my sandwich yet? I'm hungry."
Mrs. Pyle shook her head. Over her shoulder, she yelled,
"You fix it, Bo. I'm busy."
"Bodine's out at the swamp, I reckon," Buddy hazarded. Mrs. Pyle regarded him darkly. After a moment, she replied,
"I ain't saying. You can find him your own self."
Buddy sighed.
"You know, you'd save me a gall darn long drive if you'd just tell me he's not out at the swamp. I could be in a better mood when I get there."
She gave him a narrow-eyed look.
"I ain't saying he ain't," she said at last.
"Thank you, ma'am," Buddy put his hat back on.
"What I needed to know."
The male voice came again, plaintively.
"Mother ain't no cheese!"
Unless Darling folk had important business in Briar Swamp, hunting, fishing, or hiding out, they mostly stayed away. Briar Creek flowed deep and dark there, and the swamp itself was embraced by a series of wide oxbow bends of the Alabama River, which snaked slowly along on its muddy way to Mobile Bay and the Blue Gulf beyond. The swamp's bottom land was thick with trees and underbrush, and even thicker with mosquitoes and snakes, cottonmouth, copperhead, coral snake, diamondback rattlesnake. The few houses along the river weren't houses at all, but houseboats, tin-roofed and shanty-like, and liable to be swept from their moorings when the river flooded, which it did often. The CCC boys at Camp Briarwood had been cutting trees and digging ditches along the eastern margins of the swamp, attempting to drain the land and claim it for agriculture. In Buddy's view, that was a waste of time. Make work, really. An opinion shared by many Darling people. They liked Briar Swamp the way it had been in their long memory, deep and dark and free, a nearly impenetrable refuge for those who needed a place to hide out, like General Bedford Forrest's Confederate boys on the run after the Battle of Selma near the end of the war. When he was a kid, Buddy had spent a fair amount of time in the swamp, playing hooky from school, mostly, but also getting to know the place, which had a strange, almost hypnotic hold on his imagination. Long, narrow fingers of shallow bayous reached into the swamp on the riverside, their shores bordered with bald cypress, their waters home to some pretty fine gators and long-nosed gar lazing among the lily pads and water willow. Where the land rose up a few feet, the trees were mostly tupelo and gum, mixed with southern red oak, sweet gum, yellow poplar, and beech. And the waters and shorelines and trees were home to an astonishing variety of birds, dabblers like the Canada geese, mallards, gadwalls, and blue-winged teal, waders like the herons, bitterns, egrets, ibises, and wood storks, raptors like the osprey, kites, eagles, hawks, and owls. Buddy knew where a wooden skiff was tied to a swamp cottonwood and had occasionally borrowed it to fish the bayous for largemouth or spotted bass, catfish, crappie, pickerel, and sunfish. Sometimes he'd pole to a place where the water shallowed over a clean gravel bottom and hunt for freshwater mussels, southern fat mucket, yellow sand shell, Alabama orb, or for crawdads and frogs to be cooked over a campfire while the sky darkened down to night and the ivory moon lifted above the trees. Buddy hadn't been down to the swamp since he'd been elected sheriff, but he still knew his way around. What was more to his present purpose, he knew the way to Bodine's relocated moonshine camp, although he hadn't been there for a while either. He had a choice. He could drive in past the prison farm on the Jericho Road, then take the dirt two-track that curled and twisted through the trees for several miles. Or, and this would be quieter and give no notice of his coming, he could pole up Snipes Bayou if the skiff was still moored to that swamp cottonwood. It was, although he had to disturb a great blue heron and a small flock of hooded mergansers and buffleheads fishing in the dark, still waters nearby. He had to bail the skiff out, too, using a rusty coffee can he found in the gunwale. But by mid-afternoon, he had poled his way up the narrow bayou to the point where he could smell the smoke from Bodine's moonshine camp and hear the dull thud of an axe. He pushed the skiff onto the bank below a tangle of tree roots and got out. He had left his holster and gun locked in the car. He'd never been very keen on firepower, feeling that having a revolver on his hip increased the likelihood of rash behavior on both sides of the law. When he walked up to Bodine's camp in a large cleared space in the middle of a dense wood, he made it easy for anybody he met to see that his hands were empty and he was unarmed. The center of the clearing was taken up with three large boilers set up on stacks of bricks. Off to one side was a storage shack, with a row of wooden barrels and smaller kegs along one wall, and a shanty bunkhouse nearby with an iron pot of something, squirrel stew maybe, or fatback and beans perched over a campfire. At a quick glance, Buddy counted three men in the clearing. An old man, gray-bearded and gaunt, was stacking empty cans, the square 5-gallon metal cans bootleggers used to haul their moonshine instead of the glass jugs that were easily broken. A young boy in ragged overalls, shirtless, was splitting short lengths of firewood with a heavy axe as long as he was tall. Seeing Buddy, the boy stopped in mid-swing.
"Look sharp, Bodine," he said loudly. "We got us some company."
Bodine Pyle was bent over, shoving firewood under a 400-gallon black pot boiler. He straightened up quick as a nervous cat and turned around, a stick of firewood in his hand. When he saw Buddy, he relaxed and dropped the firewood. He nodded at the boy and old man, and they went on with their work.
"A little out of your usual territory, ain't you, Sheriff?" Bodine said.
Buddy always wondered if Bodine had a different daddy than his older and younger brothers, for while Randall and Beau were dark-haired, sultry, and slouchy, he was red-haired, blue-eyed, and freckled, with the straightforward, no-nonsense manner of a born businessman. He was wearing a dirty denim work shirt and jeans, and he had a red bandana tied around his head to keep the sweat out of his eyes. Bodine had never been one to shirk hard work.
"Maybe so," Buddy allowed affably. "Still in my county, though."
It was true. The entire swamp was in Cypress County for whatever that was worth. If you asked the county commissioners, the swamp was more a liability than an asset. It didn't produce anything but some timber and a lot of mosquitoes.
"You got time to talk?"
he added, as if this were a casual meeting in front of the courthouse or at the diner.
"Don't mean to take you away from your work."
"Hang on a minute," Bodine said, and reached for a wooden paddle fashioned out of a piece of beech. He climbed up on top of the boiler and took off a lid.
"Fire's about to take hold. Have to give this here batch good stir."
If you were making corn liquor or peach or plum or apple brandy for your family or your neighbors, and plenty of darling folk did, you probably used what was called a turnip pot, a copper boiler about the size of a half barrel, small enough that a man could carry it on his shoulder. All you needed was your turnip pot, 40 or 50 pounds of fruit, and twice that much sugar, plus a source of clear spring water. Once you had all that, you were cooking. One or two runs and you'd have enough for the whole year. But if you were in the business of making moonshine for money, you'd have a black pot still, or several of them, that held up to 800 gallons of fermented mash apiece. Cobbled together from boards and sheets of metal, the black pot boiler was set up above a fire pit on stacks of brick and filled with the makings of mash, cornmeal, usually, or a varying mix of corn, rye, and barley meal, sugar, yeast, and water. The quantities were daunting. For each big black pot, you'd need 100 pounds of grain meal, 800 pounds of sugar, some yeast, and enough water to top it off. You might also want to pour a couple of 80-pound sacks of wheat bran on top of the mash to hold in the heat of fermentation. Getting the supplies without getting caught required some skilled advanced planning. Once it was all in the black pot, the mash was left to ferment with an occasional stir. Then a fire was lit under it, and the mash was boiled, releasing the alcohol in the form of steam. The steam was run through a coil of copper pipe, the worm, in a vat or box of cold water, cooling it into a liquid. At its most potent, what came out of the worm was 150 proof, 75% alcohol, with a knife-edged explosive jolt. White lightning, white dog, tiger spit, hooch. After the black pot had been run once, more sugar could be added to the mash and the process begun again. Shiners could get as many as 6 or 7 runs of tolerable liquor out of one pot of mash, although they might have to settle for less potency in the later runs. Buddy had heard it said that black pot moonshine didn't have the fine taste of liquor produced in smaller quantities, but it was cheaper to make, and most drinkers didn't care what it tasted like as long as it had plenty of firepower. Corn whiskey was never aged the way bourbon whiskey was up in Kentucky and Tennessee. It was simply siphoned off into metal cans, packed into a fast car, and run down to Mobile or up to Montgomery. Buddy sat down with his back to a nearby sweet gum tree, keeping an eye on the boy and the old man. Bodine, whistling Dixie, finished stirring, climbed down from the pot, and hunkered Indian style beside him. He stopped whistling and reached into his shirt for a crumpled pack of Camels and a matchbook.
"Heard you busted Pootie McKay," he said.
Buddy shrugged. "Just doing my job."
"You ain't busting none of my haulers."
Buddy thought about that.
"Haven't crossed my path yet, I reckon."
The boy had gone back to his splitting, and the silence was broken by the solid thunk of his axe. Bodine swatted a mosquito on his neck.
"Tell the truth, I've been expecting you, Sheriff," he said. "I've been wondering why you ain't showed up out here sooner, to pick up where old Sheriff Burns left off. Pick up his cut, I mean."
Buddy was puzzled.
"His cut?"
"Sure."
Bodine rubbed his thumb and first finger together,
Moolah, gravy.
He pursed his lips. I paid him $10 a week plus $5 a load protection fee. Reckon that'll work for you?
Protection fee. And then Buddy understood and wondered why in the hell he'd been so oblivious for so long. No wonder Roy Burns had been live and let live about Bodine's moonshine, and probably Mickey Ledoux's, too, before Mickey got busted. And maybe the small local shiners as well. The sheriff had his hands in their pockets. Folks had been paying him to turn a blind eye. For a moment, Buddy was surprised. And then he wasn't. He was just mad at himself for not cottoning to the racket sooner. Burns's nice house, his wife's cook and housekeeper, their vacation cottage, that big motorboat on Oyster Bay, all the signs had been there. He just hadn't been smart enough to put the picture together. But being dumb in the past was no excuse for not being smart now. "Give me a minute to think on this," he said. Bodine bent a match against the matchbook striker, lit it with a jab of his thumb, and held it to the tip of his cigarette. He narrowed his pale blue eyes, and when he spoke, his voice was colder.
"You figure on asking for more?"
He paused, frowning.
"Bear in mind that I got other obligations, Sheriff. If I pay you more, word'll get out, and I'll have to come up with more for them. But then I'll have to add that to the price of the shine."
He shook his head.
"Drives up the cost for everybody."
Buddy wanted to ask what those other obligations were, but now didn't seem like the right time. He turned this new and surprising situation over in his mind, trying to sort through all the ramifications, but it wasn't easy. Bootleg operations were one thing, an ongoing bribery racket was another, and there could be more he didn't know about. Finally, hesitantly, he said,
"I reckon what you gave Roy will be okay for me. I don't want to upset the apple cart."
He frowned.
"For now, anyway. We can talk about it again later after I've had a chance to see how things are going."
"Swell," Bodine said. He reached for his wallet. "How about if we start right now?"
He took out 5 tens and handed them over.
"This is for the last 2 weeks, plus the 6 loads that have gone out in that time, which somehow didn't cross your path."
With a grin, he added a 20.
"And this is for good faith, because we're pals. We got a deal, Sheriff?"
Buddy folded the bills into his shirt pocket and buttoned it shut. This thing was too damn complicated for him to dope out on the spot. He felt like he had just stumbled into a nest of angry rattlers, and every single one of them was buzzing around his feet. The arrangement between Roy Burns and Bodine Pyle might have been a small-time, short-term private transaction, one man to the other, or it might be something bigger. Bigger than what? Buddy couldn't even begin to guess. And starting from where he was right now, a position of total and complete ignorance, it might take weeks to figure out. And in the meantime, he knew one thing. He was between a rock and a hard place. It didn't feel good, and he didn't see any way out. But there was something that had to be said right here and now before Bodine got any other ideas.
"Yeah, we've got a deal, Pyle. I'll overlook what goes on out here, for the moment, anyway. But that doesn't mean you get a free pass in town. Long as you do right, stay out of sight, and don't give me any heartburn, we're pals. Give me or my deputy a bad time, and the deal's off."
He gave the other man what he hoped was a steely glance.
"You got that?"
Bodine didn't look pleased, but he nodded.
"Yeah, I got that. Anything else?" "I need to know where you were last night."
"Last night?" Bodine seemed surprised. "I was over at Pete's pool parlor playing pool, most of the night anyway."
He flicked the ash from his cigarette.
"How come you're asking?"
"Who else was there?"
"Well, Pete, of course. That little tattooed guy who works at the prison farm. Bragg, his name is. The warden's fair-haired boy.
Bodine blew out a stream of smoke.
A couple of officers from the CCC camp. Archie Mann, he's a regular. A few others in and out. Pete could tell you, I reckon. There's a poker game in the back.
The warden's fair-haired boy?
How long were you there?
Bodine hesitated.
Went in around 8, I guess. Stayed until just before 11.
Then what?
Then I went over to the exchange. My girl, Lila Jean, gets off work at 11. I walked her home and we sat on her front porch swing.
But he refrained from inquiring what they were doing there.
How long?
Bodine gave him a crooked grin.
Until Miss Crisp, Lila Jean's mama, came out and ran me off. 12:30, I guess, maybe a little later. Shame, too. Lila Jean and me was just getting warmed up.
More cautious now, he slid a glance at Buddy.
How come you're asking?
He said again, more emphatically.
So you weren't here last night,
Buddy said, watching him.
Or out on the Jericho Road?
Nope,
Bodine said promptly.
Pokey over there.
He jabbed a thumb in the direction of the old man.
Pokey was out here all night, minding the fires. Got to keep the heat steady, you know. Can't let the fire go out, can't let the pots boil dry.
Buddy leaned back against the tree, remembering Wayne's report, and thinking of what Mrs. Whitworth had told him.
You said Bragg was there from the prison farm. What time did he leave?
Bodine frowned.
I don't know. Pretty early, I reckon. He played one game and then quit.
He took a drag on his cigarette.
I'd still like to know. How come I'm asking,
Buddy said evenly, is because Whitney Whitworth went off the Jericho Road at the foot of Spook Hill last night. When he was found this morning, he was upside down under his Pierce arrow, dead.
Whitworth? Oh, hell.
Bodine's eyes widened and his jaw dropped.
You're kidding.
Not,
Buddy said.
You didn't know?
No.
First I heard.
I was over in Monroeville all morning getting supplies.
Bodine pulled the red bandana off his head and threw it on the ground.
Bad news.
He sucked on his cigarette.
Damn bad news,
he muttered.
Why?
Buddy asked. What's Whitworth got to do with you? When Bodine didn't answer, he made his voice hard and loud.
What's Whitworth got to do with you, pal? Come on, let's have an answer.
Somewhere a crow squawked. The boy stopped splitting wood, and the old man turned around to look. After a moment, Bodine said,
Look, Sheriff, you and me, we're partners now, so I've got no reason not to level with you. I got a business to run. I've got markets down in Mobile and up in Montgomery asking, begging for more. I need experienced haulers. I need cars.
He made a sweeping gesture that included the entire clearing.
I need more boilers and condensers. I need more boys out here working for me, and I can't get any of that unless I got more capital. Without capital, I'll always be just a damn two-bit backwoods operation. That's what Whitworth was to me. The damn goose that laid the golden egg.
If that was true, it pretty much canceled Bodine out as a suspect, Buddy thought. He looked around the camp.
So how long had he been in on this?
He was one of my earliest investors, Bodine said. Came in with some cash 3-4 years ago. Last week he told me he was ready to come in with more. I was counting on him.
His voice was bleak.
Nobody else in this county has money that he's willing to invest in the bootleg business. With Whitworth gone, I'm back to where I was, operating on a shoestring.
You didn't see Whitworth yesterday?
Buddy asked. Did he have any reason to be coming out here? Bodine shook his head.
Ain't seen him since the middle of last week, and no, he was only out here a time or two. He didn't like me visiting his house, neither. Didn't want his wife knowing what he was up to, I guess. So we met out by the old airfield to do our business.
He pulled down his mouth, looking glum.
I hate to say it, Sheriff, but if you were thinking to make some extra money out of our partnership, you're going to be disappointed. Would have been a whole lot more for you if Whitworth was still around.
But he couldn't argue with that. Anyway, he had the feeling that Bodine had said all he was likely to say. He stood up.
I guess that does it for me, then, at least for now.
Bodine got to his feet and stuck out his hand.
Let me know if there's anything else I can do for you, Sheriff. Always glad to help a partner out when I can.
Partner. Buddy had a sour taste in his mouth, but he managed to dredge up a small smile as he shook Bodine's hand. He thought it was a good time to leave.
Chapter 19. Lizzie Takes Pictures. The exchange operator couldn't connect with long distance, and it was past 3 by the time Lizzie was able to reach Mr. Mosley in Montgomery. He listened to her report, expressed dismay at the news of Whitworth's death, and said, "Let me think about this for a few minutes, Liz, and make another call. You stay there at your desk. I'll get back to you as quick as I can." When he did, he began with a request for the exchange operator in his most sugary voice, the one he used with difficult female witnesses.
"Mabel, honey, I need to talk to Miss Lacey private-like, if you don't mind. I'd appreciate it if you'd get off the line now."
When they heard the audible click, he spoke briskly.
"Liz, I've just spoken to Wayne Springer over at the sheriff's office. He says they have evidence that another vehicle might have been involved in Whitworth's crash."
"Another vehicle?" Lizzie was surprised. "But what?"
"It's not clear, but Springer thinks there may have been a rear-end collision somewhere on that hill, and it could have sent Whitworth's car out of control and down the embankment. With that in mind, I need you to do something. I would do it myself if I were there, but I won't be there until tomorrow. I want it done right away before the sheriff thinks of doing it. Are you game?"
"Of course," Lizzie said, and then added more cautiously, "I'll do what I can."
"Good. My Brownie camera is in my right-hand desk drawer, along with an extra roll of Kodak film. I want you to get it."
"Camera?" Lizzie frowned. "Now what?"
But when Mr. Mosley had explained, she felt a little better. She looked down at her notes and said,
"This thing that you want me to do, it sounds like we're assuming that Mrs. Whitworth is still our client. Is that right?"
"She's our client until she tells me otherwise. In writing," Mr. Mosley replied firmly. "She may be upset when you tell her what I've asked you to do, so make sure she understands that we're doing it to protect her interests. As her attorney, I need to know the extent of her culpability in this case, and she may not be willing to tell us everything."
"It sounds like you don't trust her," Lizzie hazarded.
"Every client has something to hide."
His voice was flat.
"I don't trust Regina Whitworth to tell us everything I need to know to defend her, if it comes to that."
Lizzie was startled. "Defend her against—"
"At worst, against a charge of vehicular homicide. There are no witnesses. We don't really know what happened on that hill."
"Oh, dear," Lizzie whispered.
"Hang on," Mr. Mosley said. "I don't believe she's the suspect yet. But Norris and Springer may get around to that after they've had a while to think about it. I have to know everything there is to know, just in case."
He added more sharply, "You keep your lip buttoned, Liz, especially when it comes to that young sheriff. He's easy to talk to, and you may have to guard against being too chummy with him. Client privilege, remember." "I will," Lizzie promised. She hesitated, wondering if she should tell him about Desiree's note and the meeting with Freeman that Sally Lou had arranged for that evening. But there wasn't anything to tell, not really. She would wait until after she'd heard what Freeman had to say, if anything.
"Good girl. You go on and do what I said, then call me and let me know what you find out."
His voice softened, warmed.
I'll be home tomorrow. But in the meanwhile, it's awfully good to know I can count on you, Liz. You're always right there when I need you.
Pleased, Lizzie found herself smiling. Thank you, Mr. Mosley. I appreciate that.
He cleared his throat. But when I get home, we're going to have to talk about your hours.
He sounded uncomfortable and unhappy.
I took another look at the office accounts this morning. We're owed quite a bit of money by a lot of people with no way to collect, given the economic situation. We obviously have a problem, and I'm afraid it's much worse than I thought.
Hearing the unhappiness in his voice, Lizzie felt suddenly cold. Was he trying to tell her that she would have to leave? She didn't have many bills, but she didn't have many savings either. Nadine Fleming had made it clear that she couldn't count on royalties from her new book, which was likely to earn her almost nothing. Every job in Darling was already taken. Where could she find work? How would she manage without a regular salary coming in? Would she have to move somewhere else to find another job? But she kept her apprehension out of her voice.
I understand, she said. We'll work it out, don't worry.
She said goodbye, hung up the phone, and went into Mr. Mosley's office to get the camera. She was trying not to think what her life would be like if she no longer worked for Benton and Mosley. The front door of the Whitworth house was already draped in black crepe, the usual symbol of mourning for the homes of the Darling bereaved. Lizzie knocked, and Desiree opened the door. She had changed her white apron for a black one, and her white maid's cap now bore a black ribbon.
"Why, Miss Lizzie," she said, surprised. "Wasn't expecting to see you back again so soon."
"I'm here for Mr. Mosley," Lizzie said. "I need to speak to Mrs. Whitworth. Is she seeing company?"
"No, but she'll see you," Desiree said.
She stepped back, holding the door open.
"She laying down right now, but I'll tell her you're here."
Discreetly, she dropped her voice.
"You and Freeman gonna get together like I said?"
"Tonight," Lizzie replied in a near whisper. "Sally Lou is bringing him over to my house after supper." She frowned. "Really, Desiree, I do wish you'd tell me."
"You just talk to him," Desiree said.
She raised her voice cheerfully.
"You go on into the parlor. I'll fetch Miss Wentworth."
Lizzie sat down on the garnet love seat in the darkened parlor, took the brownie out of her handbag, and put it on the walnut coffee table. When she got it from Mr. Mosley's desk drawer, she saw that the film in the camera was completely exposed. She could tell by the red number in the camera's little window. So she had stepped into the closet and loaded the new film, hoping she was fitting it properly into the take-up spool. Brownies were easy to manage, but it sounded like these photos might be terribly important, and she didn't want to make a mistake. She waited for 10 minutes or so, listening to the canary singing cheerfully in the neighboring room. The faint fragrance of rose potpourri hung on the still air. In the corner of the room was a piano with a piece of sheet music, Stormy Weather, open on the rack. Lizzie remembered that Mr. Whitworth had been one of the lucky four clovers, and that she had heard them singing Stormy Weather just the week before. Who would replace him in the quartet, she wondered. It would be a challenge, especially with the barbershop competition coming up in just a few days. Finally, Regina Whitworth came downstairs. She had changed into a black dress that emphasized her slimness, with long sleeves, a bit of lace at the cuffs, and a simple lace collar. It made her look fragile and vulnerable and young, too young to be a grieving widow. But beautiful, like a rose that has been crushed by an early frost. Her dark brown hair was still worn down to her shoulders and pulled forward, presumably, Lizzie thought, to conceal the bruise, and she wondered again how it had happened. Mrs. Whitworth sat in the upholstered club chair on the opposite side of the coffee table. Desiree came in with a tea tray, a china pot, 2 cups, sugar and lemon, and went out again, careful not to glance at Lizzie. Mrs. Whitworth poured tea and handed a cup across the table.
Desiree says you have something important to talk to me about, Miss Lacey. Lizzie added sugar to her tea and stirred. I'm sorry to disturb you, she said sympathetically. I know this is a difficult time, and you must have a lot on your mind. However, I've been in touch with Mr. Mosley, and he's asked me... But Mrs. Whitworth didn't let her go on. There's not going to be a divorce, she interrupted. So I've decided I don't really need a lawyer. She picked up her teacup and sipped. I can ask Mr. Duffy over at the bank to help me go through my accounts, so I won't need Mr. Mosley for that either. She put her cup down again. He's been very kind, but please thank him for what he's done and ask him to send me a bill for his services. Lizzie had been expecting this. I'm afraid that's something you'll have to tell him, she said. In writing. Until he receives that notice, he's still your attorney, and because that's the case, he feels duty-bound to look out for your welfare. She paused. In fact, that's why I'm here, Mrs. Whitworth. She set her cup on the table. He spoke with the deputy sheriff this afternoon. He asked me to tell you that it's likely that the sheriff will come here and ask to take a look at your car, the one you recently bought from Kilgore's, she added, just so there was no misunderstanding. My car? Mrs. Whitworth stared at Lizzie. But why in the world would the police want to look at my car? Because the sheriff has reason to think that another vehicle might have been involved in your husband's accident. Lizzie said gently, perhaps even caused it. She gestured toward the camera on the coffee table. Mr. Mosley has asked me to take a few photographs of your car. He feels that we should document the fact that it hasn't been involved in an accident, that there is no damage. No damage. Mrs. Whitworth's eyes widened, and she shrank back into the cushions of her chair. But I'm afraid there is. I mean, well, to tell the truth. Her voice trailed away. Lizzie frowned. Mrs. Whitworth, do we have a problem? There was a tense silence. I hope not, the other woman said at last. She hesitated, then pulled her hair back, exposing the bruise and abrasion on her cheek. Actually, I did have a bit of an automobile accident yesterday, I'm afraid. She spoke apologetically. That's how I got this horrible scrape on my face. She rubbed her left sleeve. And on my shoulder and arm, too, so I'm wearing long sleeves. I'm still a little sore. Uh-oh, Lizzie thought. So that was the explanation behind the mysterious abrasion. Mr. Mosley would not be pleased to hear this. Aloud, she said, What kind of accident, exactly? Well, I'm not a very good driver, you see. I'm still learning. Frank says I was very lucky not to be hurt worse. Frank? Lizzie asked blankly. Mr. Harwood. Coloring, Mrs. Whitworth hastily corrected herself. Perhaps you've heard that Kilgore's has been offering free driving lessons with the purchase of a new car. I bought mine several weeks ago. She shifted uneasily in her chair. Mr. Harwood is my driving instructor. He was in the car with me when the accident happened. Lizzie stared at the woman, suddenly remembering the confession in her interview with Mr. Mosley, the one she had typed just that morning. Frank Harwood, who was as good-looking as Mrs. Whitworth was beautiful, was more than just her driving instructor. When pushed, she had admitted that she had fallen in love with him and was thinking of marrying him after she and Mr. Whitworth were divorced. No doubt that was why, as Ophelia had noticed, she hadn't wanted the sheriff to know about the divorce and why she was so uncomfortable right now. But was there something else? Lizzie took a breath and confronted the question straightforwardly. Mrs. Whitworth, I hope you're not telling me that you were involved in your husband's accident, you and Mr. Harwood. Mrs. Whitworth pressed her fingers to her lips and shook her head violently. "Oh, no, no, really, Miss Lacey. Please believe me. I don't know anything about what happened to Whitney. But my car..." She swallowed. "What I'm trying to say is that... well, I'm afraid it's damaged. Yes, it certainly is, and I'm sorry. I mean, I didn't intend to. It was an accident, really, and it has nothing to do with Whitney, I swear."
"I see," Lizzie said evenly. "Well, why don't you just tell me what happened?"
"Yes, yes, of course. Frank, Mr. Harwood, I mean. Last night, Mr. Harwood and I were out on the Monroeville Road on that long, straight stretch just past the old sawmill."
"Last night?"
"Yes, I'm afraid I didn't quite tell the truth before. I didn't go right to bed after Whitney left. I went out with Mr. Harwood. I was practicing driving and probably going just a teensy bit too fast."
She smiled, then realized she was smiling and stopped.
"But it felt so good, you know, just so good. The top was down and the wind was blowing my hair. I felt freer and happier than I've felt since before, well, since before Grandmama made me marry Whitney, when I was young and still had everything to look forward to."
She glanced up at the portrait of her autocratic grandmother staring down her patrician nose.
"Sorry," she muttered. "Forget I said that, please. I shouldn't have."
Lizzie was remembering that Regina Whitworth had been just a teenager when she married the much older Whitney Whitworth. It was understandable that she would like to recapture some of her earlier freedoms. The car, her car, may have represented that. But what was this business about her grandmother making her marry Mr. Whitworth? She was tempted to ask, but Mrs. Whitworth was hurrying on with her story.
"Anyway, it was dark, and I was maybe going a little too fast. A deer ran across the road, and instead of trying to stop, I swerved to miss it. I fell against the door. It's one of those silly things that have the hinges on the rear. It flew open, and I tumbled out onto the road. That's how I got this scrape on my face."
Mrs. Whitworth gingerly touched her cheek, and on my left shoulder and arm. The sweater I was wearing was completely shredded.
"Oh, dear," Lizzie said.
"Mr. Harwood is right. You were lucky."
That is, if she was telling the truth. Lizzie wanted to believe her, but Mr. Mosley's doubt was still fresh in her mind.
Mrs. Whitworth nodded.
"If Frank, Mr. Harwood, hadn't been so quick, the car would have been wrecked and he might have been killed. He managed to get it stopped, but not before it sideswiped a tree and the door, it was still open, was ripped off its hinges. I hope the sheriff doesn't look at it and decide that I had anything to do with Whitney's accident."
She paused, biting her lip.
"But if they don't believe me, Mr. Harwood can tell them what happened. He was with me."
Lizzie started to reply and then stopped. If the matter came to court, Mr. Mosley would be reluctant to call Frank Harwood as a witness, since his relationship to Mrs. Whitworth would likely come out, and his credibility would be questioned. But Mr. Mosley should be the one to share that with their client, after he had talked to Harwood. She leaned forward and picked up the brownie.
"I think I'd better have a look," she said.
"And Mr. Mosley asked me to get some pictures of the car. I hope you won't mind," she added. Mrs. Whitworth stood, clearly unenthusiastic.
"If you want to take pictures, I'd better back it into the driveway where there's more light. I'll get the key."
Lizzie helped Mrs. Whitworth push the garage doors open, revealing her convertible, a sleek, beautiful pumpkin-colored Dodge parked inside. As far as Lizzie could tell from where she was standing, the car was undamaged, except for the door on the driver's side. It was completely missing. The door itself, which appeared to have a few scratches, was propped against the garage wall.
"Frank, Mr. Harwood, says it won't cost much to put the door back on," Mrs. Whitworth said.
I was going to ask him to get that done today, but then Whitney turned up missing and... She sighed heavily. Well, fixing the door somehow didn't seem important. But now that Grandmama's Pierce Arrow is wrecked, I suppose I'll have to get it replaced,